conventional means that we have for talking about God in conversation are ultimately conventions and cliches, and of course, God is anything but that.
Coming up on In Contrast, A Rabbi in Search of God with Rabbi Justin David. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions. Rabbi Justin David is the spiritual leader of Congregation Bnei Israel in Northampton, Massachusetts. He was ordained by the Jewish Theological Seminary of America and is a graduate of Oberlin College. He's the author of Longing, Jewish Meditations on a Hidden God. Welcome to In Contrast, Rabbi David. I'd like to start by asking you to define for me your conception of God.
Thank you, Ilan. It's an honor and a delight to be here. So to define my conception of God or Judaism's conception of God, it's essentially undefinable. You and I have over the years talked about Moses Maimonides, and I keep going back to him as my first step where he says essentially you can't define God because if you define God, you limit God and God is limitless. So I start there as Hillel, the great sage who lived during the time of the Second Temple over 2,000 years ago said, the rest is commentary. I really believe that. When we talk about a conception of God is just that, a conception. And what I find in talking about God is that the conventional means that we have for talking about God in conversation, it could be casual conversation, it could be academic conversation, are ultimately conventions and cliches. And of course, God is anything but that. And I think the struggle, is to have a discourse about God that busts those cliches and conventions.
What do you say to people, Rabbi David, who are convinced that they will never be convinced of the existence of God and that one can have a life healthy, vigorous, diverse, without engagement with a higher being?
They might be right. They might be right for them. When I think of being convinced, I think of a certain kind of mind that's able to look at the data of experience and the evidence that comes through life and to form conclusions that are airtight. That's not me as a person, regardless of God. I haven't developed the scientific mind or whatever, but I often feel that the most fruitful part of my own experience is confronting those moments of paradox and confusion. A friend of ours who's a biology professor at a local college is someone who I would describe as I wouldn't say he's agnostic or I wouldn't say he's atheist, but I would say he approaches his life very much within that scientific evidence-based framework. And he readily admits in public conversation that there's the domain of what he knows and there's the domain of what he doesn't know. And he's not saying, you know, there's what I know and beyond that there's God. He's really not saying that, but he's someone who admits that the ability of the mind to comprehend and gather data and form conclusions only gets us so far.
Your new book, Longing, is an exploration of yours and of sources and the people in Judaism in search of God. But as you put it in the subtitle, it is a hidden God. Yeah. It is not a God that is maybe manifesting itself all the time. I'd like to ask you first, before we go to that concept of what a hidden God is or might be, to connect it as you do in the book with your own quest for your father, who, as you describe in the book in autobiographical ways, disappeared from your life. And that left a very deep impression. And you connected in very eloquent ways, in very philosophical ways, with your quest for a higher, maybe father figure. I want to see how you connect those two.
Yeah, I want to see how I connect those two also. The book is an attempt to put down thoughts that are always unfinished. And so it's just part of the journey. I'll start with the personal experience, because really that's where the book comes from. I grew up, my parents were divorced when I was very young. That's certainly not an unusual story. And my mother had custody, although there was an interesting arrangement there. And my father would visit on weekends. And from my earliest memories of my father, I really had this reluctance to be with him at an early age. And then that reluctance passed as I got older and I grew close to him and he remarried and I was close to my stepmother and I never remember her as not being in my life. And they had a son when I was about 8 and I was up until then an only child. And I was thrilled to have this half-brother and my father and stepmother really made an effort to have us be a family. And it was really a tremendously happy part of my life from the time I was about 8 or so. And then I grew closer, even closer with my father over those years. And a lot of fun to be with him. There was a lot of joy. I'd see him on weekends. And as I got older, I would sleep over. And as I got even older, I spent a month in the summer with them. And things got so good that my father filed for custody. He wanted to file for custody and asked if I would come live with him. And even though the arrangement that I had with my mother and my grandparents looked kind of untraditional, I was actually very happy where I lived and can imagine a child not wanting to divide one's parents. So basically, I didn't want to go live with him. And at the time, that was sort of the end of that. And then about 3 years, a little more than 3 years after my half-brother was born, I went to spend 10-day winter vacation with my father and stepmother and my half-brother. And that was the last I saw of him. And he just cut off contact. He didn't call. He didn't write, except for maybe an occasional birthday card. And that was it. And because of the broader family situation, I know there are many, many families where co-parenting is a very successful thing and there are difficulties, but everyone does their best to make it whole. My extended family couldn't function that way. And so from the time I was 10 until the time I was 16, I had no contact with my father. And then when I was 16, I was feeling my power as a teenager, decided that if I'm really going to grow as a person, I need to confront him. Not necessarily to have a relationship with him, but to confront him. And I talk about this in the book, how I was really set to do battle and triumph. And at that meeting, he revealed his truth, which was that he just couldn't take it. He couldn't take the whole dynamic. And that was that. Over the next 12 years or so, I try to reestablish contact with him. And there's various back and forths and revelations and eventually kind of acceptance on my part. But something very interesting happened over the years, which is that not so much that I found God, but that at the same time that my father and I had this moment when I was 16, that was a real burgeoning time for me of my own spiritual life. And not so much my spiritual life in understanding God, but as it is for many Jews, my spiritual life in terms of my connections to Judaism, which were immediately through my synagogue youth group and my rabbi, and we all went to Israel on this incredible trip together. And around that time in my life, I made a decision that even though I didn't know if God actually existed, I would make an effort to understand the Jewish God. And so it wasn't lost on me as I was thinking about this, that my confrontation with my father and my effort, desire to try to understand the Jewish God have a similar point of origin. And there's a lot to say about my journey through the years, but I would say to sort of neatly describe it, my father went into retreat and stayed there. And I would try to reach out to him, and I wouldn't exactly get back radio silence, but certainly not the kind of engagement in any form that I was reaching out to get from him. And what I found with the Jewish God is something actually quite wonderful and paradoxical, which is that for much of Jewish tradition, God is actually hidden or absent. Our spiritual ancestors, the Israelites, wander for 40 years in the desert, and there are actually only a few times when God intervenes to show the people that God is there. So for 40 years, God is really absent. But the paradox of that is that despite the appearance of absence, God is actually most fully present in that absence. And I find that compelling for many reasons, not the least of which is that in our contemporary sort of popular spiritual culture, there's a real desire to have kind of a personal relationship with God, an immediate experience of God, some kind of return on our effort to draw close to what we think of as God. And actually, I've had quite opposite experience that I have over the years come to understand and embrace an experience of God that is very much a real experience, and full and rich and emotional, but in many ways rather impersonal and rather diffuse, in which God's presence is, at least appears to be absent.
The father figure that you are describing, that cathartic moment at age 16, mm-hmm. Was your father a religious person? Did he himself have a connection with spirituality, with a search for or around God?
Not particularly, but he was a very Jewish person. My grandmother, his mother, was a refugee from either Poland or Ukraine. The stories and the borders keep shifting before the war. And she was a very powerful influence in my early childhood up until the time that my father pulled back. And she was really a repository of Yiddishkeit, of Jewishness, of Yiddish, of Hebrew, sort of the old world in the new world. She wasn't a very new world person at all in many ways. But she herself, interestingly, was not particularly traditionally religious. It's just that she actually herself came from a religious environment. But it's just that the love of what it meant to be a Jewish person was something that was so fully alive in her. And because of her accent and because she was so different from the Americans I knew, people who'd been here several generations, and because she loved me deeply and fiercely, she really made a deep impression on me. And so in part, when I go back to the well of Jewishness, whether it's through ritual or community or texts, in part I go back to her, as conflicted as my feelings are around her in my life. And despite the fact that my mother's grandparents, who are actually quite secular, are people who practically raised me and for whom I have so much love.
You have talked about the Jewish God, and you do so frequently in your book as well. I wonder if that means that different religions have different gods, and by calling this the Jewish God, one is de facto portraying that a higher entity embedded in the theology and in the liturgy and in the rituals that come with it. Is there one God? Does each religion have a different one?
Hearing you say that I spoke about the Jewish God, I'm recoiling internally and wanting to make all kinds of proofs, all kinds of corrections to the text here, because as we talked about at the beginning, to limit God in some way is really to do violence to what the whole idea of God is about. And so to say there is a Jewish God as opposed to a Muslim God or a Christian God or God of all creation is really to limit God. I would absolutely say that God is a universal. But of course, there are infinite ways of understanding God. And I think when we use the term Jewish God, or if I were ever to use it, I would mean it in the most simple descriptive way, which is to say the way in which the infinite is given some kind of articulation by this particular tradition with this particular historical experience and approach. And I think the task, in many ways, is to wrestle with that so as to tease out what are the universal elements that can be accessible to someone regardless if they've been raised in any tradition or no tradition or have no vocabulary for it. Because really, if God is a thing, I shouldn't say a thing, if God is a being, if God truly exists, then the concept, the idea, the experience, the intimation needs to be available, accessible in a universal way.
One of the arguments against the existence of God is that we anthropomorphize the higher being. God is hidden or is revealed. God creates or destroys. God gives love or generates hatred. God is a he or a she. All qualities or all characteristics of us humans, we, like artists, create in our minds or create outside of our minds visions of a larger artist that created us in our own image. Mm-hmm. To what extent is the language that we use, the English language, Hebrew, Yiddish, French, whatever human language, already simplifying the approaches that we might have to God? I'm here inviting you to think of the connection of the human language that we have and how we talk about God.
Yeah. You and I have talked over the years about David Foster Wallace, and I wonder what he has to say about God. He actually does say something very powerful about God in a famous speech that he gave to graduates of Kenyon College. I think this is about more than 10 years ago, in which he says, each of us has a default setting. And he says to the graduates, choose a God or choose a religion or choose something to worship, because if you don't choose, you'll go to your default setting and you will worship something and it will crush you. You know, and he goes through this wonderful litany. If you worship money, you'll always feel inadequate. If you worship beauty, you'll die a thousand deaths. And it's really a very powerful speech that I happen to love and other people think is a bit mawkish, but I like it. But I really wonder what he would have to say about language and God, because he has this wonderful essay about dictionaries in which he talks about how there needs to be some framework for language, but language is always changing. And I would have loved to hear him reflect on God language in that vein. In contemporary Judaism, I think the feminist revolution in religious thought is so crucial from a Jewish perspective, because one of the first things that Jewish feminists did was look at the language around God in prayer and in stories, and to create new prayers and new stories and new metaphors. And because of the literary richness of Judaism, they were able to do that from within and still doing it. And we always continue to do that, and to draw on the plethora of metaphors that are found, for example, in the Hebrew prophets and in the Midrash, the rabbinic stories that reflect on the Torah. And in that great literature, we have the images of God as a mother, God as a midwife, God as a healer, and God as source of life, which is both gender neutral and yet, because of the peculiarities of the Hebrew language, is feminine. The divine presence of the Shekhinah in Kabbalah, of course, is feminine. And even though all of those metaphors were in one way or another most probably formulated by men, when we take them in our hands, we have a lens through which we can re-envision what God is. Because the previous metaphors, of course, limit what God is. And as we expand the metaphors and change them, we can expand that repertoire. Now, why do we need to do that at all? Well, that too is an interesting question. I would say a few things. One is, as Jews, we rely on ritual and we invoke God to be present in those ritual moments. The other is that we have this beautiful tradition of storytelling. And so we need names for the characters of the stories. And God is the character who looms over every story.
You have been talking about the use of metaphors to describe God and the connection, in response to the question that I asked, between language and the divine. But is it possible to think that God itself is a metaphor?
How so?
In the sense that it replaces another concept or another dimension, that it names it in that substitution. That is what a metaphor does. In that, dangerously, it could be reduced to a figure of speech.
Yes, absolutely. And I do talk about this in the book as well. The modern American Jewish philosopher Mordechai Kaplan had a radical idea, a radical for a rabbi and a teacher of rabbis and a self-avowedly religious person to say, which is that for him, God was not a supernatural being. God was a concept articulated by human beings through historical experience.
Right.
And for Kaplan, one of the ways in which people experienced what they call God is through what he calls interrelatedness, which is simply the experience that human beings share among each other and that human beings share more broadly to the entire natural world and to all creation, this realization that we are all part of the same stuff and one part acts upon the other and that there is an ultimacy. He wouldn't use that word, but I think it's a good one. There is a sense of the ultimate, a sense of grandeur, when we really take a moment to take stock of what it means to have a relationship with another person, to be outside and to interact with the elements, to be afraid of the elements, to be delighted by the elements, to look to the stars and to imagine what lies beyond. And that sense of grandeur, says Mordechai Kaplan, is what we call God.
The role of the rabbi, Rabbi David, has changed dramatically in the last 100, 200, maybe 500 years. Yeah. You were talking about the importance of sources, the storytelling, the way that language itself describes in different moments in Jewish tradition the divine. I can think of the role of the rabbi in the Middle Ages as being more isolated, community connected, but because of the juncture in which the Jews found themselves, not quite interacting with the environment. Mm-hmm. I can think of biblical times of celebrated rabbis that were activists, engaged, provocative, and even politically blunt. And of course, in the United States, rabbi today has taken, maybe I would say, without in any way wanting to be demeaning, a performative role, a role that serves as a model, but is also in some ways acting in front of the community, a community that can feel lost, disoriented, disengaged, disattached. I'd love for you to do in this conversation, as you do in your wonderful book, a little personal explanation of how you became a rabbi. And in doing so, telling us as well what the role of the rabbi is in these trying times. You have been honored for your activities in civil disobedience, in civil engagement, in your role with refugees, your role with people who are vulnerable in our societies. You are known as a spokesperson for these groups, and you push the community that you represent in Northampton, Massachusetts, in order to be more engaged. Social justice plays a crucial role. But there are moments in Jewish history where the rabbi is not connected with social justice. The rabbi is even shying away from any large act. What makes the rabbi today act politically? Or should the rabbi today act politically? And how do you see yourself having become a rabbi and having changed as a rabbi?
Yeah, what wonderful questions. If we had another 5 hours, maybe I could begin to answer them. But I talk about this in the book, too. I had a rabbi as a teenager who had a profound impact on me. He was very young at the time. He was about 28. He was the son of a very well-known rabbi from Europe who was a great teacher. And he had this real charisma. He was very performative. He could get up and give this sermon that everyone would fall in love with. And when he would interact with you, he would make you smile. He would make you laugh. I always felt that there was more there. There was a real depth there. And I talk in the book about how he introduced me to Martin Buber. He loved Martin Buber. Being an acolyte of his in high school, I was in his office one day and I asked him who this Martin Buber guy was. And he explained Martin Buber in about 5 seconds. And I've read Buber and read about Buber. But it was really that moment where he taught me everything that we needed to know. And he said, Martin Buber talks about two kinds of relationships. There are I-it relationships. He said, like I have with this ashtray, right? No one has ashtrays anymore, but that's what he said, like I have with this ashtray. And then he said, and then there are what he calls I-thou relationships, which are the kinds of relationships we want to have with people and with God. And this personality who was in my life, who was so charismatic, who was learned and thoughtful and wonderful in so many ways, really did so much for me as a teenager, gave me a sense of home outside my home and gave me a sense of intellectual and moral and spiritual aspiration and was at the center of this community where I really felt like I belonged and can thrive. And I had this thought when I was 15 years old, I want to do for other people what he's doing for me, which as a 15-year-old is a great thought. As a 25-year-old in rabbinical school is an okay thought. As a 35-year-old rabbi is a horrible thought, which is to say it was certainly more than enough to propel me to make all the kinds of decisions I had to make to decide to go to rabbinical school and that this was a life that I wanted. But over the years, I've had to sort of find my own voice in the rabbinate and discover and rediscover my motivations for being here. And there are many. Part of my motivation to go into rabbinical school was that I had this real curiosity, I don't know where it came from, to learn traditional Jewish sources in the original. I've always had a desire to be part of a community, and I've always seen the role of communities, and particularly Jewish communities, as embodying a moral voice. And I decided to become a congregational rabbi because there was something I sensed in myself that would be not just well-suited, but where I would find tremendous satisfaction in being engaged in the life of the community. And it's not that I saw myself as the center of attention or I ever aspired to be the great orator of a generation or any of these grandiose things, but I really had a sense that of all the ways of being in the world, congregational rabbi was something that would be fulfilling to me. At the heart of it, when I was much younger, but also now, is really the quality of personal interaction that one has with people and the kinds of moments and insights that that yields, both for me and for other people. And that's really been a constant. Authors have elevator speeches, so do prospective rabbinical students. And in that encapsulated presentation that I would give to people before I entered rabbinical school, I would tell people, well, a rabbi has an opportunity to be with people at critical moments in their lives and to learn from that and to maybe share the wisdom of this tradition. And really, that's been the core of my rabbinic work. And social justice is a part of that because to be a full human being, to be sensitive to other human beings and their needs and their wants and desires, and to have those same wants and desires oneself, I think is to place oneself in the real sort of brokenness of this world.
All of us at the same time get impatient with ourselves. We feel that we come short. we see others with envy and we model ourselves in ways that might be impossible. You might not want to go too far on this, but here's the question.
Yeah.
Where do rabbis today come short and where do you come short?
Well, I always think of what Shakespeare said, desiring this man's art and that man's scope. That's my life. That's my life. And I always wish that I could know more of the tradition, remember more of the tradition, have the thoughtfulness to make it apply to people and to be able to communicate it in a way that would be as exciting to people as when they look on their phones and find some silly YouTube video. But I'll tell you where I think the popular religious world and the Jewish world is no exception falls short, which is that we're always looking for stars. We're always looking for someone to dazzle us, someone filled with sex appeal, someone who's going to give us this vision that we've never had before. And it's quite a grandiose set of expectations to place on human beings. I mean, all those things may be valuable to some degree in and of themselves. I'm certainly for vision and excitement in my community. But I think it's important to remember that we're all ordinary people. Each ordinary person has something unique to give. And so what I reconcile myself to is that Jewish tradition actually imposes on us a series of really quite remarkable demands for how one conducts oneself with other people, for a moral vision about the world, for inner spiritual life. And my work as a rabbi, both personally and publicly, is to do that work as I can as Justin, and I can't do it as Justin the way that you can do it as Ilan. Mm. To the extent that I'm a public figure, I have the unique privilege and blessing and burden of articulating these things in public ways.
Not too long ago, you were arrested.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Sure. So there was the first time and the second time. And I say this with some, not sheepishness over being arrested, and not with false humility, but with real humility, because the whole point of being arrested in a nonviolent demonstration is that it's really not about you, it's about the cause. But then I'm a public figure, so I have to talk about how it's me, and that's the contradiction. But the first time, I was attending a rabbinic conference sponsored by an organization called Truah, the Rabbinic Call to Human Rights, which is a group of rabbis and cantors, I think about 1,800 across the U.S., who are concerned about various human rights issues, and we belong to this organization. We do activism together. We promote their work, et cetera. And right after our president was elected, this organization, Truah, called for a conference in New York in February, and I signed up for the conference. And about 2 weeks before, I got a phone call from the director of the organization saying that she wanted to, there were about 200 rabbis who were going to be at this conference, but she wanted to gather a group of about 18 to 20 who would walk in peaceful demonstration to the Trump Hotel in Columbus Circle and in protest of the travel ban at the time to have about 20 rabbis go into the street, sit down, disrupt traffic, and get arrested. And my first thought was to ask her, well, why are we doing this? Yes, the travel ban is horrible and everything this president stands for is anathema, but I always understood the act of being arrested as being an act that you did when you had no other choices. And as a white male rabbi of relative privilege, there were certainly other choices at my disposal to protest this. And I was showing up at airport demonstrations and I was sending letters to our local Muslim community and speaking to my congregation, et cetera, et cetera. And the director of the organization said, well, you know, parts of the Jewish community are accommodating themselves to the president, and this would be a powerful demonstration that leaders aren't buying it. And I said, well, let me talk to my family and I'll let you know. It was a Friday that I got the call. Saturday, I went into the synagogue. And at some point in the service, I shared with people I'd gotten this call and here are my doubts about it. I'm curious to hear what people think. Part of the service, we take the Sefer Torah, the scroll, and sing and walk around congregation. And as we were doing that, this 80-plus-year-old woman, not someone who I thought of particularly as an activist, came up to me and she said, I'll pay your bail money. And one by one, people came up to me and said, we'd really love to see you do this. And it was a tremendously humbling experience because it made me realize how what I can do really does have symbolic power. And so I agreed to do this. And we didn't have a lot of training. I sat with a friend and colleague who's been arrested dozens of times. And she gave me the lowdown on what to do when you're arrested, which is to be thoroughly consistent, respectful, embody the values that you want to project, and you treat the police officers as if they're your friend. Yes, officer, no, officer, thank you, officer, that kind of thing. And when we did it, it was actually quite traumatic. It was at night, which typically activists don't recommend that you do. There were, I don't know, how many police cars stopping traffic with lights in our face. It really was a dramatic moment. But the whole time, I was thinking of a teaching, a Hasidic teaching that I learned in a book, was talking about Moses and Pharaoh and saying that the response to Pharaoh is to say, I am nothing. Because to say I am nothing means that through me, anything can be revealed. I'm just a vessel. And that's what I said to myself as we were being arrested. This is not about me. I'm not the important person here. I am just a vessel through which all of this is happening, which was actually quite important because even though I was with 20 people and this was prearranged with the police and I wasn't really scared of anything going wrong, in the moment, sitting in the middle of Columbus Avenue with the lights of a police cruiser staring me in the face, I noticed my heart was beating faster than it normally does. But I noticed it. I wasn't getting caught up in it. And that was very important.
And there is a second time?
There was a second time. This was much more specific. This was about 3 months ago. The Pioneer Valley Worker Center has gotten behind this gentleman, Lucio Perez, who has a deportation order, and he's currently living in sanctuary in Amherst, Massachusetts. At the time, he wasn't in sanctuary, and there was the possibility that he would get a stay of deportation. And because he was such a great candidate, he's been here for over 20 years, he has children who are U.S. citizens, very fine human being, the Pioneer Valley Worker Center took on his cause. And there were a series of escalating actions. The last one was to do a Jericho walk around a building in which ICE has offices, and then to have about 16 or 18 of us sit down in front of the doors and risk arrest as a way to publicize his case. And that action was actually tremendously impactful in a very specific way, in that because of that action, Senator Markey's office called ICE on Lucio's behalf, Senator Warren's office got involved, Congress McGovern's office got involved, and it was a real exercise in democracy because we want these people to act, but they really need us to get out there to show them why they need to act.
As you were speaking, Rabbi David, I was thinking of the word symbol and symbolism that you kept on using. I had become a symbol for my community, I had become a symbol for my people, and how that connects with the other idea that you had been talking about, the metaphor of God. To what extent becoming a symbol for your community, representing your community, ceases to be your choice in certain actions, and it becomes the choice, as you channel it, of the community? How do you negotiate or bargain what is yours for yourself and what is yours for the community that you represent?
It's a great question, and it's exceedingly hard to answer in the moment because being a rabbi, and especially being a congregational rabbi, that symbolic quality to one's life is just a given. And it's there whether I ask for it or not, whether I want it or not. And the best illustration I can give about it is, in terms of its conflict, has nothing to do with the stance that I've taken, but simply how I live my life. Early on in my rabbinate, my kids were very little. And the great existential problem for me wasn't, are people going to judge me for my work or for my stands or anything like that? It was, will I have enough time to spend with my kids? Especially my first 3 years in the rabbinate, I was in a large congregation in Washington, D.C., where there was no time for anything. And that was really when I felt the greatest pull between having to sort of be on the clock and do the work so that the work could get out there and everything a rabbi is supposed to do and be and stand for is out there, and simply being there for my family. And I always felt that I wanted to be there for my family and not miss those moments and contribute and all of that. Now my kids are much older, and I find actually that I have a lot more time to devote to my work. I find that very fulfilling. And if there's a but here, it's only that I just have to face the fact that I'm a human being with limited energies and that there are things I need to do at times to pull away from the community to recharge my batteries. And that's really the only limitation. The other dynamic here, which has to do with the question you asked about limits, about rabbis taking stands, there's an unspoken training that we get as rabbis, not necessarily from teachers in school, but in conversations that we have and ideas that we build up about ourselves, that on the one hand, it's important to take stands. On the other hand, we don't want to alienate anybody or make people feel like they're less than if they don't have the position that we do. And I think that inhibits a lot of rabbis from really cultivating their own voice. Whether by choice or whether it's been imposed upon me, I found myself at odds with people who had very different positions on particular issues, whether it related to Israel or any topic that's coming up. I don't want to shy away from anything political, but I always look to sort of transcend political language, because when people say something is political or politicized, the way I understand it is they mean it's limited, because the political problem most often is a human problem. When Trayvon Martin was shot, that was a political problem, but it was really a human problem. And there is kind of a reflex that rabbis learn to develop to avoid the politics. But what concerned me earlier on, and much less now, is that by avoiding the politics, you're really avoiding the most important moral issues that we have in front of us.
To bring this to a close with some pain, because I'm enjoying the conversation very much, I want to go back to your book, to the title of the book, yes. Longing, and to the way that word spreads all over and irrigates the entire narrative. Longing is such a beautiful word. It's such a powerful word. It's such a mysterious word. Can you define it for me? And in what way are you shaped with the absence of your father that you talked about, with your political engagement, with the need to go beyond politics to see the human side, with the tension between the individual and the community, and with the sense that a rabbi has to live in the present? What's longing for you?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think of that famous poem by Zelda Mishkovsky, the great Israeli poet who wrote in Hebrew. And she wrote this famous poem, the Chol Yeshem, Each of Us Has a Name. It's a litany, and one of the lines is, each of us has a name given to us by our longings. So I see longing as simply a feature of human existence, if not maybe one of the defining features of human existence, in that each of us experiences loss and fear and some kind of abandonment just by being human. But we also may learn in that loss that there is something around the corner. There's another connection to be made. And we may not be making that connection yet. We may not be making those connections to fullest satisfaction. And so in the wake of the loss, that sense of something else being there is engendered in us. And that's longing. And I think God in Judaism is so emblematic of that longing, because God is certainly present throughout Jewish tradition. But God is also so absent throughout Jewish tradition. And when Moses was on Mount Sinai and arguing with God over the fate of the people who constructed this golden calf, and God says to Moses, step aside, I'm going to wipe them out. And Moses says to God, God, you can't do that. And Moses wins that round of the argument. But then there's the second round of the argument where Moses says to God, you know, the people are going astray because you're not there. They can't see you. And God says, show me your face. And God says, no. I'll pass all of my goodness before you. You'll see my back, but you won't see my face, because no human being can see my face and live, which is to say, you can't have that complete connection and still be a human being. To be a human being is to know this ultimate connection through intimations and hints and signs. And I think each of us has that. And so for me, being a rabbi is to really be in that world. And whether the longing is for justice, whether the longing is for the wholeness of community, whether the longing is for understanding, closeness to God, closeness to other people, it's there. And I find it's really the fuel of my personal life and the fuel of my work.
With admiration and humility, I thank you very much for coming and being a guest in Contrast.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Ilan.
The search for a higher being is an integral aspect of the human quest. We might embrace it or deny it, depending on our disposition. Either way, we reckon with it through life. The word God comes from Old English and is derived from Proto-Germanic. Its etymology is uncertain. We tend to use the capital G at the beginning as a sign of respect. And for a long time, cultural patterns have dictated masculine attributes to the divinity. Those traits are rapidly changing. Religious texts in different languages use other words. In the Hebrew Bible, the Tetragrammaton, YHWH, is spelled out as Yahweh. In Greek texts, the term is Theos. In Latin, Deus. Of course, how we portray the higher being, how we even name it, how we refer to it says much about us. Karl Marx believed religion was the opiate of humankind. Sigmund Freud argued that it was all an illusion. And Gottfried Leibniz imagined ours to be only one of many universes created by God and not necessarily the best and most efficient one. Seeing God as a presence might be comforting to some. Others choose to explain God as an absence, a higher being that is shy, disengaged with creation, or simply hiding away. In Platonism, God looks for subsidiaries called demiurges. These are artisan-like figures in charge of keeping the various universes running. This implies that God might take a leave of absence. My own life has been a constant dialogue with the divine, a dialogue sometimes made of words and sometimes of silences. I was raised Jewish in Mexico, which is predominantly Catholic. God for me is inside and outside, stronger and weaker than me. It is a code word for excellence, moral certitude, the fight for freedom, and the need for justice. My God loves to be revealed through stories. There is a penchant for the dramatic, maybe even the melodramatic in these stories. And secrets, lots of secrets. My God lacks uncertainty, chaos, confusion. I often get angry at God, and happy too. Most often, I long. Longing, according to Merriam-Webster, is a strong desire for something unattainable. The unattainable is essential for me. It keeps me on my toes. Next time on In Contrast.
If we lose our language, we lose so much knowledge and wisdom. We lose what we are made of, what our wisdom teaches us, and all of Zapotec history.
The poetry of Zapotec poet Irma Pineda with Karen Werner and Wendy Call on the next In Contrast. Let us know what you think about In Contrast. Review us on Apple Podcasts or send an email to radio@nepr.net. You can also follow us on Facebook, where we invite you to share your comments on this program and others in our series. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. I'm Milan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio and Quixote Productions.